We managed to crawl through the first 17 verses, but there was so much richness there. We learned Paul, called apostle, the doulos, the slave of Jesus Christ. We talked about what it meant to be called. We talked about how he was eager. He was under obligation. He was not ashamed. And then we came to the great theme verses for the gospel, of the power of God unto salvation. First to the Jew, but also to the Greek. For the just shall live by faith. Or the righteous shall live by faith. And it was sort of our introduction. And I guess it's now our third Sunday, we've been in the study of looking at what is sin. The doctrinal term is soteriology. And so we're talking about what is this thing called soteriology. And we looked at, as we moved through it, that the wrath of God was being revealed. Just like the gospel was revealed, the dunamos, the power of God, the TNT, the word dunamos, we got our word dynamite from. Well, we see here that the wrath of God is being revealed as well. It's coming from heaven against all ungodliness and all wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And so as we begin to look into the study, we begin to understand that godlessness is that which we do against God, where we try to proclaim that God doesn't exist. We talked about the wickedness of men, where those things that we do against our fellow man. And it was in this context that we look at it and said, because they suppress the truth, they keep the truth from being known. And it said that the truth was evident within them, since that which we know about God was plain to them, because God had made it plain to them. We talked about this as not an accidental writing, but Paul repeats himself, but he's making an emphasis. And because God has made it so, and because man knows it to be so, it is evidently plain before them. And last week we talked as well, that since the creation of the world, his invisible qualities, and those qualities being his divine, or his eternal nature and his divine nature, his eternal power and divine nature, that they too are being understood through which was made, for they have been clearly seen. We talked about this oxymoron, if you will, this ironic or this interesting contradictory statement that the invisible things are clearly seen. We sort of stretched our head and said, what in the world are you talking about, Paul? How can we know that that which has been made is plain? Well, we talked about last week that the heavens declare the glory of God. And we saw that this thing we call general revelation, we brought four characteristics into being. We said it was a clear testimony. We saw that everybody understands it. We saw that it had gone out since the creation of the world, but it was a limited revelation. It wasn't a revelation that you might know that Jesus died on the cross, but you would know there's at least a God. You could see the existence of who God is, and that God would bring further revelation, but there was at least this general revelation. And we moved on that since that was to be known by God is plain to them because God had made it known, we started walking through the various verses, and I'm just skipping through the slides that we talked about last time as we were moving through. We came to this, is that since the creation of the world, and Paul begins to introduce the consistency of what this has been known. Because remember, one of our characteristics of general revelation is that which has been known and always known. It's not something you needed to know about. It was something that God had made known since the very beginning of time. And as he began to introduce this topic, we said that his invisible qualities. We asked the question, what in the world is a quality? And I think Eric told me it was an attribute. And we talked about that another way to think about this, that God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. And we sort of talked about one of the books that I read as a high school student, Robinson Crusoe. You might remember the story. He was walking along the beach, and he saw footprints in the sand. As he looked down at those footprints, he noticed they weren't his footprints. And he sat there, and he scratched his head and says, this is very amazing. Look at the way the wind and the waves have come in and carved footprints. Isn't this absolutely amazing? Random chance. Just the wind blowing across the sand. Just the power of the surf pounding on the beach head. There obviously is a very random pattern here. Looks just like somebody else would be here, but I would never conclude that I've never seen them. That's really not what the book said. But that's sort of what we say. Because remember back in 118, it says, we suppress
the truth. We ignore that which is self-evident. Now, had he seen somebody else on that island? No. They were invisible. But they were clearly evident to him. You see, the invisible can clearly be evident many a time. I don't know lots of stuff that I get in. I don't know that there's a third floor to a building that I've never been in. But I get in the elevator and I push the button. And by faith, I think I'm going somewhere. And I get off the elevator. And lo and behold, a third floor was there. Now, there wasn't any evidence. All I saw was buttons. How did I know? Those invisible attributes made themselves clearly known. Because it was being understood from that which had been made. The evidence of what was sitting out there told us that there was a God. And began to proclaim it to us. We saw that Colossians tells us that in his image, in the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, the invisible God makes himself known. How? We ask the question. We talked about this, that this phrase is eternal power. That word eternal is a phrase that appears only twice in the entire Bible. Once here, and once over in Jude, where it talks about the everlasting chains. So we said, you know, we're going to be really hard to understand what eternal power is, but we can sort of fathom what it might be as we begin to see how it is used. By the way, that word power is that word dunamos, again, that TNT. That same thing we saw back in verse 16 that we talked about. So as he comes up here, it says, his eternal power and his divinity. We begin to ask the question, what is this eternal power? We talked about Moses when he meets God at the flame, at the burning bush. Remember, the bush wasn't consumed. And he says, well, who are you? And he says, the I Am. The all-existing one. The one from the beginning of time. The one that doesn't even know what time is. The one that existed before time and after time. I am who I am. That is the one who has sent you. That is the one who has proclaimed to you. This is the one that is bringing things into being. He said, I am the one who has no beginning point. Because I created that which was. Before it was, I was. Because I am. But it wasn't. But it came into being. And I brought it into being. That's who this I Am is. So you say, his eternal power. It must be the power that brings about creation. Because that's who God is. And so it says, by his eternal power. That power that brings about that which doesn't consume but burns. That power that brings about life. That power that brought about creation. This is one of those attributes. And he says to them, and it says that the astronomer looks up there into the sky, and he looks at all the patterns and all the rings and all the various consortiums, and he comes to the conclusion that it's a random chance process. I attended a fascinating seminar this weekend on apologetics, and they were talking about if we just had a 1/10,000th of a degree change in our gravitational pull, we wouldn't be here as a planet. We were just a few feet further, we'd be crispy critters in terms of being too close. If we were a few further away, we would be frozen. But this planet is just sitting at just the perfect place. Random. Chance process. Just happened. Like those waves just caused footprints to appear for Robinson Crusoe. We began to talk about how God's eternal power manifests itself, and that the Creator has made himself known. That the wind, I don't know if you thought about rain and how things happen, the cycles, the sunshine, the stuff that comes upon us. We talked about all those things last week. And we started ending here as we approached the only thing between you and lunch was Bert continuing to talk. And I could see the stomachs, the invisible evidence that if I said much more, I'd be in real trouble. So we stopped so that we could be first in line. And some of us bolted out there. And Bert stayed back and talked to some people. And was one of the last lines and realized why you guys wanted to be first. But as we left here, I said we would pick up here today where it talks about his divine nature. This word, divine nature, is a very interesting word. It appears only here. I wish I could tell you in lots of other places to try to figure out what it is. but it's a very, very old Greek word. It comes from a Greek word that is based upon a word that we get a word theos from, theos, which means God. The Latin gets where it gets translated when the Romans were taking over the Greeks. They picked up the Greek language as they translated it into. They translated this word divinitas, which would be divinitas, which means divine in English. So we get the idea that outside the Bible, this sort of connotes divinity. It is a very sister word. If you drop that I out of the word, it's related to it. It's used, the only time it's used in the Bible is over here in Colossians. Chapter 2, verse 9, which is the Christ of all the fullness of the deity, there's that word without the I, lives within him. So we get this idea that there's something with God-likeness, the Godhead. Some of your translations will read. The NIV reads divine nature. Different translations wrestle with this word, but I think essentially if we were to look at it, we get the idea that it's a summation of all of who God is. It's his essence, his nature, his character, his divinity, his deity. It is a summation of all that makes God who he is. F.F. Bruce put it this way. If God's divinity is shown in creation, the fullness of that deity or his essence is embodied in who Jesus is. That's why Paul is writing this, when he tries to talk about. We look at all the glory of the universe, and you want to know what's going on. That's who Christ is. He's the fullness who God is, how God has made himself manifested in seeing what's happening. Paul refers to this divine nature more generally when he tries to describe it, and he says to it that it's the sum of the invisible perfections. Now, what are perfections? That's another old English word that deals with our attributes, or that which makes us complete. The sum total of all we are. So in your handout, I gave you the start of a study on the attributes of God. I gave you 10 attributes. His omnipresence, his omnipotentness, his omniscience. You know, all those big theological words. I love Josh McDowell when he was speaking this weekend at the conference I was attending. He said, you know, when I was growing up, I couldn't understand all those theological words, so I made up my own phrases that helped me remember. So when he says, omnipresent, God is here. Isn't that easy to remember? God is here. All present, God's here. Omnipotent, all-powerful, God has power. Omniscient, omniscience is to know, all-knowing. And he began to understand, as he began to talk about the simple words that all was theological words, he began to understand who his God was. And he challenges those at the conference to take a systematic theology and read one paragraph on an attribute of God every day. There's over 365 attributes you can find out there. So you'll have a whole year study. But can you imagine knowing intimately 365 things about God? Well, I gave you a head start. I gave you 10 of them in the paper when I called it His Essence. It's the last part of that page. And I gave you all, excuse me, I didn't give you all. I gave you the beginning of what you will make all as you study your personal values of what you think God is. And I want to help you because one of the things we're trying to do in the book of Romans is to understand who God is. And I'm going to, and it says here, his eternal power, his omnipotent, his omnipotent, and his essence, his divinity. Well, what are all those other things that make up this divinity? These perfections that characterize God. The total of all of which God is in his divine attributes. Paul chooses two of those attributes. Power and the fact that he is divine, because these specifically deal with the act of creation. He says in here that God's invisible attributes are manifested in his visible works. His immenseness is shown as we look at the galaxies, we look at how deep it is. You know, we used to think there's only a few thousand stars, and right now we're running out of numbers to describe how many stars we're finding. As Hubble continues to look deeper and deeper into space. Scriptures tells us there are about the number of sands on the seashore. I don't know if you've been counting them recently, but there's a lot of them out there too. The people often made fun that the Bible wasn't very accurate. Because there were a lot more sands on the seashore than there were, I think it was 2,800 some odd stars in Kepler's day when he was doing his writings. But he said, I know there are more there because God tells me. Interesting. He believed, though he couldn't see. Those invisible things don't. Well, anyway, that mass of immense tells us something about God. It tells us about his all-powerfulness. The variety, his contrivance, that we see out there as we look across at all the things that are out there, tells us not only is he all-powerful, but he's all-knowing. He can put it together in just the right order. The adaptation, these beautifulness that he provides us, tells us about his generosity for us. And so again, his invisible attributes are made known by the creation we see. God's work proves his being, shows that he's out there. The fact that the cycles work tells me he's a God of order. He's a God that puts things into being and they exist. Or they can be random chance processes. They just happen. I mean, to be fair, that is another alternative. One takes faith, the other takes faith. I personally believe one takes less faith. But that's up to us, each of us, to come to our own conclusion as we wrestle through it. But creation and providence form the twofold demonstration of God. His perfection, his attributes are shown to us in nature. And the way nature is exercised shows that he's involved with his creation. He's not just what some of our forefathers were called deists. They believed that God launched something and then went off on a vacation and didn't care anymore. He was absentee landlord. That's not what we see in our scripture. We see God is active in the lives of his people. In the scriptures, Paul writes here, it says, these attributes of a God allow us to clearly see him. It's interesting. That word, if you translate it into four English words, has been clearly seen, is in the Greek in its present passive indicative format. And that's a bunch of English major students. It basically says, this is a phrase that says, something that has happened in the past, it continues to manifest itself into our present and continues to work through. Has been and continues to be clearly manifested, clearly made to us, that we cannot deny it. Some say they see this manifestation in nature, that God is a God of nature and God has manifested itself. They consider the implications of the complexity of nature. It's sort of like if I were to take you to a mystical planet for a moment. We're going to take a rocket, we're going to get in, we're going to blast off, we're going to land out there in some world we've never been on. And we come off our space shuttle, and we see a colony of robots. Mechanical beasts running all over the place, doing what they do. And the obvious question is, how do they get there? Random chance. They assemble themselves based upon sunlight baking down on them. After all, we all know if you put enough junk in the junkyard and you leave enough light on it, a brand new 2012 car will come rolling out of that junkyard one day. No, that didn't quite work that way. It comes out of intelligent design. Oh, that's that other argument. We're trying to figure out which side we're on. But you would see those robots and you begin to ask the question, where did this complexity? There must have been something that put it here. Why did it exist? Let's take a trip to another planet. We come off that planet and we find an inscription, some encoded language that sits out there. And we begin to look at that language. We begin to understand that it's intelligent and it communicates something about it. Now, we might call it the SETI project, where we, in computer science, are broadcasting patterns into the universe, hoping that some other intelligent life will hear them, because we believe that when you see these patterns, you will know there's an intelligent source. So I land, and I see this inscription. We call it DNA. It's a language. It encodes something called life. It's an interesting problem. DNA is made up of protein. But DNA needs protein to exist. But the instructions, it tells us how DNA exists, is sequence protein that you need another DNA to do. So where did you get the first one? Random. Just happened. His invisible attributes tells us who he is. He's a God of all power. My idea is that it would be mind-boggling. You know, it says, the eye is not seen. I tell you, there's a lot of things we haven't seen yet. We used to think the atom was the smallest thing we can have. You know something? We can see inside atoms today. We're finding out there's a whole universe inside an atom. So many particles, so much empty space in there. We had no idea. We thought it was as small as there was. Man is not seen. But Hebrews will tell us that the invisible things manifest God. They show us by faith. That God has placed in the conscience of every man that still small voice that encourages him to talk about good versus evil. That encourages him to understand. You know, how do you know that there's good? How do you know something is evil? How do you know something is moral? How did you learn that? Somebody taught you. Well, where did they learn it from? It implies the very nature that we talk about morality implies that there must have been somebody who created good or bad. Some type of system, because if there isn't, it's just a random chance process. That's what I said, the atheist really has a hard time talking about being moral. Because morality by its very nature implies a system of good and bad, and someone had to decide what was good and what was bad. And so I have a lot of problems with my people who claim to be atheists. And I said, fine, then you really don't care if I kill you or you kill somebody else. Oh no, that's wrong. What's wrong? Where'd wrong come from? This concept. You see, it's a consciousness that's been put within us. Because his invisible attributes have been clearly seen. These qualities about life, that God created man and equipped him with the intellectual power and the objective stimulation to use it, that he could humble himself and reverently and awestruck look out there and say, there is a creator, because I know in my heart. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but every single culture that we've ever discovered, bar none, worships something. They may worship the moon, the stars, the tree, the frog,
money.
But they worship something. There's an innate need to worship. And God says, I want you to worship me, not my creation. My creation is the point to me, but you suppress the truth. You see what how we backed up to 18 we started this morning? The suppression of the truth leads us to not understand that God's invisible qualities, his divine nature, his eternal power, there's two of them, have been clearly seen, that they have manifested themselves, that we can understand, or we can insult God and say, you don't exist. It's an option, to be fair. It's an alternative. We can look out there, and we become ignorant of the truth, and we have no one to blame but ourselves. Now, I've already jumped ahead of myself. I'm down at about verse 21. Because Paul's going to get there, but I'm going to back up here and try to bring this back up. Well, William Hendrickson, in his commentary on this thing, says the original Greek employs a pair of words which resemble each other in form and express a seemingly contradiction. A closer look at the original, however, will see that his unseeable qualities are clearly seen. While these eyes, observing the glories of the universe which God created, the soul, which is invisible to the eye, and is deeply impressed. It clearly sees God's power displayed in the things that are made, that is, the things where God manifests his work. You know, you talk about your emotion. People say, I love you. You have children. What's love? It's a visible attribute. But you know it. You can see it. How do you see it? You see it with the eye of the mind. You see it when you don't try to suppress the truth. J.B. Burroughs, in his commentary on the Daily Bread, made an interesting statement. I just want to read it to you. It says, the Himalayas are raised letters, like God's Braille, which upon the blind children put our fingers to spell out the name of God. The human race is like a blind man feeling his way along a treacherous path. Man, to some extent, is legible in the book of nature, but only in a limited way. In nature, we see God's fingerprints. But as sinners, we need to see Christ's nail prints. Mm-hmm. You see, general revelation doesn't tell us about Calvary, but it shows us the fingerprints, that there's a finger out there. And maybe there's a finger, there's a hand that's reaching out to say, I love you. I want to have a relationship with you. So Paul makes a statement that these things have been clearly seen, being understood.
Again, one Greek little word. This one is also in the present passive participle of the word that we get an outcome to mean to have an intellect, to understand, to know. Some commentators interpret this as that which is being seen by them and only them because they understand it. They suppress it, they can't know it. Because this is those things that they do know. Because they know it, they could suppress it. Because you say, well, what about the person who never heard? But the scriptures we talked about before don't tell us of that. We know things and we choose to suppress it. And he said, revelation demands a response. If we choose to suppress that which we already know, God has no obligation to bring more knowledge. Last week, just before we went on out for the picnic, who it was? Carol. He was sitting there watching. Carol told a story about the missionary who found in Africa this guy that said he knew there had to be a God. He just prayed that God would bring somebody to him, and this missionary showed up on his doorstep. Fascinating stories. How God will bring people to come to know him. But we need to respond and understand. For them, the evidence is submitted to our intellect. And it arrives and tells us we can know that there's a true God. The scriptures continue, for what has been made. Again, here it's just one Greek word. We in English take a lot of words to say that. But the idea is very similar to that we see in Hebrews 11:6. By faith we understand that the universe was formed by God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. All those microns, all those atoms, are all invisible. But you put them all together, you make visible. By faith we know this, Hebrews writes. Today science will show it to us under various forms of experimentation. But the creation delivers a clear, unmistakable message about God and his person. You see, it's not just that there are random events, but there's order. There's design behind it. This word that we see up here on the screen means more than the original act of creation. It includes the continual operation of that work. When the Greeks use that phrase, it's not just what had been created, but it's the evidence that it continues to perpetuate itself. It continues to, if you will, recreate itself. This outward creation is not the parent, but it's the interpreter that there must be a God. It points to somebody else. Don't fall down and worship the signpost. Worship the sign that it, worship the place the signpost points out to. It points to God and helps us to understand that there's an innermost need. In Romans 1:20, put this way. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine natures have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And it's more than that. Knowledge of God is not merely available. It's our present possession. We have that knowledge. The question is, what do we do with it? Do we suppress it? Say it can't possibly be true? Man knows who God is, but man chooses to either step out and possess that faith or chooses to deny it. And Paul is wrestling with here. He's building a case of why mankind feels guilty. And he says, because that which was known, they chose to suppress, and therefore they are without excuse. The word is here, so the men are without excuse. It's a little bit longer. We see our interesting word right here. Apologetos. The word that's used over 1 Peter, be ready to make a defense. The conference I was at this past week was an apologetic conference dealing with, it's not learning how to make an apology, by the way. It's learning to give an answer for our faith. It's learning to proclaim, to speak out, to give evidence of it. And it says, because we do not know and use intelligently that which God has provided, we are without excuse. We're without a defense. If we were hauled before a jury and asked, are we guilty or not guilty, we'd be declared guilty. There is no defense. It has been clearly manifested to us. God has given us such clear evidence of his existence and of his claims that we are without excuse for our idolatry. We are hindering the truth. We are suppressing the truth. It is taking us to the case. And Paul will make the statement that the Gentiles are in serious trouble because they may not have known about the law of Moses. They may not have known about the great I Am, but they knew about creation. They understood
The story is often told about Pythagoras, where we get our word Pythagorean theorem from. Don't want to take you back to math class. Don't want to scare anybody. But he writes in his writings that these patterns he finds leads him to believe there must be one true God. I don't know if you know the guy by the name of Gotthard Dirks. Invented the IBM 360 mainframe computer system, mainly because of zeros and ones, because he knew there was absolute good and absolute evil. And he found over 750 patents for IBM. He was one of the engineers bringing in and launching the modern computer age. Brilliant, believing Christian, who says his faith in God led him to invent, because he was given the creative nature that God has to bring things into being. Pythagoras makes the same statement. Socrates, Plato, all of the Greek philosophers, when you read them in their writings, they get a little vain in their imagination, to be honest. But the scripture is going to tell us in the next verse that that's what happens when they deny God. They become vain in their imaginations. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. But the scripture here says, man is without excuse. He has no defense. To make a defense, everyone is able to give you, ask you, or give an account of the hope that is in you. Same word that's translated defense here is this word here in its root form. To give an apology for it. It's interesting. This is not something that's new in the New Testament, by the way. Isaiah, writing about 700 BC, puts it this way. It's a long passage. In fact, can I ask somebody to do me a favor? I am getting hoarser by the moment. Could somebody just read that loud? It's up there. Could somebody read it? Leroy, can you read it for me?
Do not tremble. Do not be afraid. Did I not proclaim this and foretell it long ago? You are my witnesses. Is there any God beside me? No. There is no other rock. I know not one. All who make idols are nothing, and the things they treasure are worthless. Those who would speak up for them are blind. They are ignorant to their own shame. Who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit him nothing? He and his kind will be put to shame. Craftsmen are nothing but men. Let them all come together and take their stand. They will be brought down to terror and infamy. The blacksmith takes a tool and works with it in the coals. He shapes an idol with hammers. He forges it with the might of his arm. He gets hungry and loses his strength. He drinks no water and grows faint. The carpenter measures with a line and makes an outline with a marker. He roughs it out with chisels and marks it with compasses. He shapes it in the form of a man, of men in all glory, that it may dwell in a shrine. He cuts down cedars and perhaps took a cypress or oak. He let it grow among the trees of the forest, or planted a pine and the rain made it grow. It is man's fuel for burning. Some of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread, but he also fashions a god and worships it. He makes an idol and bows down to it. Half of the wood he burns in the fire. Over it he prepares his meal. He roasts his meat and eats his fill. He also warms himself and says, ah, I am warm. I see the fire. From the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships. He prays to it and says, save me. You are my God. They know nothing. They understand nothing. Their eyes are plastered over so that they cannot see. And their minds are closed so that they cannot understand. No one stops to think. No one has the knowledge or understanding to say, half of it I used for fuel. I even baked bread over its coals. I roasted meat and ate it. Shall I make myself a detestable He feeds on ashes. He a deluded heart mistakes, misleads him, and he cannot save himself or say, is not this thing in my right hand a lie?
Did you get the picture? Here's this piece of wood. I take it, I grew it, I chopped it down, I take half of it, I feed myself, the other half I carve and make something of it, and then I fall down and worship it because it has power over my life. How silly, God says. Isaiah writes the thing, he spends a lot of verses saying what Paul said a moment ago, that man's without excuse, man's just being silly. He's not understanding what is transpiring. Man goes out there and he thinks good. He created it, man. So man will then worship that which he created. Man, you are really silly. You have no idea what's going on here. They have their own traditions. They have their own things about his things. I say, there can't possibly be a God. Why? Because I said there wasn't. But I'll go create an idol and I'll fall down and I'll worship it. Fragmented thinking. That's what Paul is trying to get here. He's trying to help people understand that mankind is left with no excuse. They are left because if they don't honor God, they have no other choice than to worship the creation. Because that's all that's left. They look out there and they say, I know I can see his divine attributes. I know I see his eternal power, but I like the thing he created more than I like him. So I won't give him honor. I'll go off and do my own thing. Because I'm in charge. We call that idolatry. We talked a lot about that when we studied the book of Judges. Remember, we talked about Micah and he went off and built his own little idol. We see here, Paul is talking about them being idol worshippers. How do I know that? We haven't got there yet. When you get down to verse 23, it calls them idol worshippers. It says they make things, they fall down and worship them. We're heading towards that, but he's already declaring man to be guilty. No, as I've already mentioned, but just to drive the point home. Remember, revelation leads to salvation into a personal relationship. It's called specific revelation. We're talking about general revelation. That which generally points out the existence of a God. Because once we know God exists, then we have to make a volitional decision to decide to seek after him to find out what he may be, or to suppress that truth in our minds. Do I see God as my creator? Or do I see the creation as the thing I want to worship? Do I seek the one who made the tree, or do I worship the tree? Do I worship the moon, or the one who created the moon? Observe, there are five words in these three verses to describe the extent to which God has gone to reveal himself to mankind. And I think they're a special word to note. Any of these five words would in itself would have been a strong argument that Paul could have made. But Paul puts all five of them before us in the text. You see up there. First of all, notice the use of the word all. He rebuilt heaven against all the ungodliness and wickedness. All of it. There's nothing that isn't out there. God has placed a witness within man against all ungodliness, against everything what man does against God, as well as what man does against his fellow man. One of the things we talked about when we looked at that verse, we talked about against all godliness, all wickedness, we said the great command was to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy might. And the second command was like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. What do we see here? Loving God or denying the love of God and not loving mankind. That's what those words mean. He hammers that great commandment, and the second was like it. The second, third word I want you to point out is that Greek word we talked about. We call it the planero. We went through it. It's a word that gets translated clear up here. It is clearly known to them or made plain to them because that which is plain to them, it means to manifest, to make clear, to be beyond any shadow of a doubt, the basic truth that God exists. He could have said it just once, it's plain, but he hammered it twice. All plain, plain. The fourth word I'd point out to you, that Paul says there's an inner witness of God because the individual, because they are clearly seen. It's one in Greek word out here, but they said they are clearly seen. They are not something that we cannot comprehend. They are distinctly apprehendable.
they are fully able to be known. It leaves no doubt that a person, every person that's ever walked on this earth, had the ability to know it. And lastly, the fifth word, not only could they be seen, they could be understood. Powerful phrases. You put them together. All wickedness, all ungodliness, all plainly seen, made plain to us. We can clearly see it, not only do it, we can understand it. Therefore, the conclusion, here without excuse, God is hammered on the point. Man holds, God holds man responsible for his refusal to acknowledge that which he has made known about him in his creation. Even those that have never had the opportunity to hear the gospel have received a clear witness that God himself exists. And he said, respond to that, and I will bring additional revelation, says the Lord. One last point. Many believers want to dictate the terms which God will present his credentials. They say, hey, hold it one moment, Bert. I'm in charge. I want to tell God how he manifests it. I don't like this creation stuff. It confuses me. I want to be the judge. And God says, hold it. Are you omnipotent? Are you omniscient? Are you omnipotent? Are you gracious? Are you holy? I am. I'm the judge. I don't trust you to judge fairly. You're the defendant. You misunderstood your role. You're the one who's out there on trial. And the question comes, what defense are you going to make? The answer is there is no defense. It's been clearly manifested that you're guilty. To make things worse, you're without excuse in your guilt. You can never say that God did not make himself known to you, because the very world lies as a silent testimony of the power and the goodness of God. For that matter, the godness of God. The universe proclaims the existence of God. It doesn't merely indicate a faint possibility of the existence of God. It shouts from the rooftop, God exists. What are you going to do to me? Verse 19 says that God has made it obvious to man. He says, God made it plain to them. Because God has made it plain and obvious to man, mankind is therefore without excuse. So we came up to the conclusion, we're asking ourselves, what makes God angry? That's why we said the wrath of God is being revealed. 3 weeks ago, we looked at it and said, God gets mad because man suppresses the truth. These last two Sundays, we saw that God gets mad because the evident truths are ignored. We talk about what makes God angry. We're going to have a list of five by the time we're finished. Next week, we're going to look at the whole issue that God gets angry because we don't give him his due, his honor. We know we suppress it. We ignore the evidence. And then when God comes and says, I've manifested myself to you, you should at least honor me. We say, buzz off, God. I want nothing to do with you. But seeing that it's 7 minutes of, and that's 40 minutes worth of material, we're not going to dive into that verse. So we're going to stop. I'm going to give you a little break today. We'll finish a little early. Because I want to make sure that we understand that it's not that any of us can say that God's not fair. God has been extremely fair. He's given every person who's ever lived, regardless of where they live, no matter how remote they may be, the opportunity to see that he exists. Because you see, from everywhere on this planet, you can see those stars. You can see that sunlight. You can see the glory of God being declared in the heavens. You can see the firmament, the magnitude. You can see the rain. You can see how God brings things in your life, the graciousness of God. And the conclusion is man is without excuse. The righteousness of God is being proclaimed, but also the wrath of God is being proclaimed. Because someone might say, well, if all this is true, why can't I observe more of the intuitive knowledge of who God is so that I can understand that? Why don't I? Well, that's what verses 21 through 23 are all about. They're going to tell us, not only are we ignorant, not only don't we pay attention to God, but God will come back and zap us because the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since they made known about God is plain to them because God made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible quality, his power, his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that they did not glorify him as God, neither did they give thanks to him.
Ooh. Only we learn, we don't give thankfulness. Guess what next week's going to be on? Be thankful so you don't feel guilty. I just want you to know where we're heading.
I don't want you to say, I forgot to give thanks. But their thinking became futile. You see what happens when we suppress truth? When we don't pay any attention to his attributes, when we don't pay any attention to glorify and honor God, when we don't give thankfulness, what do? We become vain in our imaginations. We become futile in our thinking. And our foolish hearts become darkened. What's a heart? Maybe. We'll talk about what heart is next week. Just trying to whet your appetite. Weeks after, we're going to talk about, for when they claimed to be wise, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for the images made like a mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. You see, they become idolaters. They take that piece of wood that we read about in Isaiah, and they carve it up, they feed themselves, and they fall down and worship the other half. Where is mankind going? That's what Paul's going to show us in the book. I titled this section, Reasons for Gentile Guilt. Why do I call them Gentiles? Because they don't know anything about the law. They don't know anything about God, the great I am. They just know about God and creation. But they already failed to glorify him. They failed to give thanks. They become futile in their imagination. Great phrase, the wise and the unwise. Remember when Paul wrote back in 1:15? Talked about the wise, the unwise, the Greek, the non-Greek, the barbarian. It's all coming back. We spent so much time camped out there that I promise you we'd move through. Harlan, you got a question?
Yeah,
is that in here? That's in next week's handout. That's this one right here. See? I gave it to you already. That's the one I handed out today I didn't get to. It's coming. I'm just previewing what's coming ahead.
What's the last page?
I'll give you that handout next week to the part of the problems. But you see, we're going to go in. The foolish of the man heart is darkened because he suppresses the truth. That's our theme for next week. We'll start diving in word by word. And we'll go through that verse again. Just like we done. But I want us to back up. And I want us to understand the context. The context isn't about sin. But understanding our sin, God provided a solution called salvation. And from salvation, we become sanctified and grow in our relationship with him because he is sovereign, which leads us to service, which is the book of Romans. And we're going to keep everything in a bigger context. But the issue is, if we don't honor God, we have no idea how to serve him. We have no idea how to give sovereignty to him. We have no idea how to sanctify and become saved because we don't understand that we're guilty. That's what Paul starts with guilt. And that's where we are. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you so much for this moment. I thank you for this apostle who took the time to pen words that can transform and challenge us as we study them. May you take this word, God, may you make it real in our lives, that we would give you honor this week. And we would be thankful that if we read about the people that don't next week, we would not be reading about ourselves. May we not be vain in our imagination. May we not deny